Blog Talk Radio.
From deepest, darkest Africa, across the polar ice cap, spanning the jungles of South America, without a compass, without a map, Blog Talk Radio and Wildlife Educational Services presents Larry Batson's Wild World. Discover the wonders of the natural world with nationally known wildlife educator Larry Batson as we visit his wild world.
Hello, everyone, from the remote jungles of Clinton Falls, Indiana. This is Larry Batson, and you are listening to Larry Batson's Wild World on this marvelous network known as Blog Talk Radio as we welcome spring in the Midwestern part of the United States. Folks, I've seen a dandelion. It's just around the corner, and we cannot wait. Of course, handling the technical responsibilities all the way from the fine state of Ohio, Melissa Hovey and Wayne Larson. And before I go any further, I want to thank Melissa Hovey for being so kind to host last week's show. It was truly outstanding with Billy Sandifer, and it was great for me to actually listen to the show for once, and I thoroughly did enjoy it. So we want a big thank you to Melissa Hovey. Also, from his massive Wild World News studios in Indianapolis, Indiana, the distinguished, honorable, and always here, Dr. Henry Day. Good evening, Doctor.
Good evening, Mr. Batson.
How's everything in Indianapolis? I'm sorry?
Well, everything here is going pretty good. We got about 51 degrees, which is pretty good for this time of the year.
Yes, it is. It is.
And you're right about the dandelions. They're back.
They're back, I'm telling you. But we might have to mow grass here soon. I will have to say this, Dr. Day. When we were covered in ice and snow, I was so longing for the day that we'd have to mow grass.
And now it's here.
It's truly here. And
we're not as excited as we were then.
I'm not nearly as excited about it, and I'm though I have to confess, I did go out and try to start the lawnmower, and it did start, so that's always a good sign. So we're very excited about that. This following portion of Larry Batson's Wild World, it doesn't take me much to get excited, is brought to you by Alphabet Swamp, the new children's book by Cheryl and Larry Batson, written by my wife, and I do the illustrations. And, folks, you can order your autographed copy today at www.larrytheanimalguy.com or send check or money order for $10 per copy to WES 4140 North, 600 West, Greencastle, Indiana, 46135. Shipping and handling is included.
It's now time from his broadcasting mecca in Indianapolis, Indiana, the distinguished Dr. Henry Day with the Wild World News.
Good evening. This is Dr. Henry Day with Wild World News. Well, Melissa, you and Wayne are going to be excited about this story. What's new at the Cincinnati Zoo?
Oh.
Well, the Cincinnati Zoo and Biological Garden is celebrating its first giraffe birth in nearly 26 years.
Wow.
A four-year-old Maasai giraffe gave birth to her first calf, whose gender is unknown. For the next few days, the pair will remain indoors, so they're allowed to bond. But I would check the website at the zoo. You're going to see a new giraffe here in the next day or so.
Well, that'd be very exciting to go to the Cincinnati Zoo. It's a fantastic zoological gardens. In fact, we many years ago got a hamadryas baboon that's mother would not take care of it from the Cincinnati Zoo. And you know why they haven't figured out the sex on that giraffe yet?
Tell me.
Is nobody can get near it. They will beat you to death with their neck. That's what happened.
That's right. That's right. Okay. Now, I'll tell you, my first experience at the Cincinnati Zoo was with you. You took me there, and I can't remember when it was, late 70s, early 80s. And we were on a mission to... You had received a call from a college professor to rescue a few poisonous snakes that had escaped in his basement. And while you were there rescuing the snakes, and I was safely upstairs, and we ended up at the Cincinnati Zoo, and it's one of the most beautiful zoos here in the United States.
Oh, it is. Absolutely is. Hey, I have a quick story that I want to tell everybody, and we forgot to mention this But, you know, I had a little accident here at the animal compound about a week ago.
That's
when
right.
I was in the snake building, I was taking care of some of the rattlesnakes, and one of the Western Diamondbacks struck the top of the cage so violently that venom spewed out and actually went into my right eye. Now, Dr. Day was alarming at first, but so I'm sorry.
Well, I was talking to you, and you said, well, guess what happened to me today? And
yeah.
I thought, well, let's see. You've got 14 alligators, 6 tigers, a couple of bears, and poisonous snakes. And what could possibly have happened to you?
A variety of things. So we flushed it out with water. It looked kind of nasty for a couple of days, but I never did lose my eyesight, and everything's fine now. And we used enough Visine. But I have to tell you a second part of this story. And I hate to prolong the news, but I called a good friend of mine in Illinois. He's quite experienced with handling and dealing with snake bite and so forth. And I told him about this. And he told me, he said, you know what you should have done? He said, you should have urinated in your hand and then put the urine in your eye. I am so glad that I did not call him after that had happened.
That you didn't know that beforehand, yes.
Because there is no way. I mean, well, I guess if it meant seeing or not, but anyway. Okay, enough of that little tidbit of information.
All right. Well, the last couple of weeks, we've been reporting on bear beware. The bears are waking up. Well, here's an interesting story from Heber, Utah. Biologists out tracking the bear population made a surprising discovery. A mother bear with 4 cubs. Scott Root of the state's Division of Wildlife Resources said they had tracked a radio collar on a hibernating sow to a den on a mountainside near Daniel's Summit in Wasatch County. Now, they sedated the mother as a precaution so they could examine her and her 4 cubs.
4? Oh, my Lord.
That's going to be a busy mother this spring.
Oh, she's going to be nuts. 4? Oh, my gosh. That's very unusual.
It is.
My God.
All right, well, here's some good news and some bad news from San Bernardino, California. A massive solar project in the San Bernardino County could displace as many as 140 rare desert tortoises, far more than the developer's original estimate.
Now, well, of course.
At least 43 protected tortoises have been moved from the site of the Bright Source Energy's $2 million project on public land. Now, it's a good thing the solar project is, but it's also a bad thing.
Well, I am sure that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is working with them to make sure that this transition of these tortoises is done properly. So, yes, I know sometimes Mother Nature has a back seat when it comes to this sort of thing. So, yeah. We'll see how that goes.
Move them very slowly.
Move them very slowly, that's right.
All right. Now, spring is in the air. This time of the year, there's a lot of nesting, a lot of new babies out there. Now, here's a story to think about. Newport,
okay.
Oregon. The arrival of spring has brought the annual reminder to stay away from seal pups on the beaches. The public mustn't touch or approach the seal pups left alone on the beach while their mothers are out looking for food. Now, some people think they need to try to rescue the pups because they mistakenly believe they're abandoned or they crowd too close to them, which prevents their mothers from returning from the sea and feeding them. Now, this goes with baby birds, baby bunnies. When you're out in nature, the new babies, leave them alone. The parents are close by.
That's right. Not unless your driver's license has Mother Nature on it. Stay away.
Leave them alone. That's right.
That's right.
All right. Now, when you wish upon a star, leave them where they are. Pawleys Island, South Carolina. The unsettled weather along the coast has caused thousands of starfish to wash upon the shore. Department of Natural Resources Marine Division spokesman, Phil Mayer, said the starfish were dislodged by rough seas from the rocks they usually stick to. Now, most of the starfish are still alive, so there's no reason to throw them back into the sea.
Well, it's just like the seal pups. Leave them alone and leave the starfish
leave
alone.
Leave them alone. They'll be okay.
You know, and they just need to educate. The TV and radio, they need to get the word out.
That's okay. What we're here for, too.
That's right. That's part of our jobs.
All right. My home state of Kansas, Topeka.
Oh.
A pair of peregrine falcons who became internet stars while nesting in a box on the West Star Energy Building have been evicted by another pair of falcons.
Oh.
The new couple, Kristen Nehemiah and Boris, moved in last week, and the female has already laid two eggs. Now, West Star hopes that the original falcons, Hope and Dorley, find home in another nesting box on the Tecumseh Energy Center.
Well, let's hope so. Look, the foreclosure crisis has also gone into the bird world.
Exactly. All right, now here's one of those stories we'll end up the news tonight with.
Okay.
That you're going to be thinking about just as you're drifting off to sleep. The kiwi, not the fruit, the bird, the national bird of New Zealand. It can't fly. It lives in a hole in the ground. It's almost blind and lays only one egg each year. Despite all this, it survived for more than 70 million years.
Isn't that remarkable? That sounds like an uncle of mine.
Well, that's the wild world news for tonight.
Oh, it was truly wonderful. We want to thank Dr. Henry Day for bringing us the wild world news with such great expertise as he does each week. We also want to thank our underwriters such as Santee Cooper Country in beautiful South Carolina, Lake Marion and Lake Moultrie, known as Santee Cooper Lakes. Folks, 171,000 acres and 450 miles of shoreline. Fantastic fishing and amazing golf. Go to their website, www.santeecoopercountry.org. And also a big thank you to Peter and Kathy Weimer and We Want You Cottages, way up in western New York. Visit today this fantastic resort on the banks of Chautauqua Lake. And in addition to their website, iKids Fishing, promoting getting youngsters interested in the fantastic sport of fishing at www.wewantyou.com. Those are our underwriters that make it possible for Larry Batson's Wild World to be on Blog Talk Radio.
Just my children and my wife. Thank my lucky stars to be living here today. 'Cause the flag still stands for freedom and they can't take that away. And I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm free. And I won't forget the men who died, who gave that right to me. And I gladly stand up next to you and defend her still today. 'Cause there ain't no doubt I love this land. God bless the USA. From the lakes of Minnesota to the hills of Tennessee, across the plains of Texas, from sea to shining sea, from Detroit down to Houston, and New York to LA, there's pride in every American heart, and it's time we stand and say, I'm proud. today, 'cause there ain't no doubt I love this land. God bless the USA. And I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm free.
Fantastic sounds of Lee Greenwood joining us tonight. We have an amazing guest. He was with us, oh gosh, about a month ago, representing what I've always thought the greatest agency of our United States government, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. God bless every one of them. Senior writer for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service from his home in West Virginia, David Klinger. Hi, David.
Good evening, Larry.
Wow, that was a pretty good song to open you up with, huh?
That's pretty impressive. I don't know if I can live up to all that, but we'll try tonight. You know, it's an honor to be on your show and to be asked back a second time. I must be doing something right.
You absolutely are. It's our pleasure. We love the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and as I've said in the past, everyone that we've had on with that agency, they've been fantastic guests. So we're completely thrilled to have you on tonight. We'll be bugging lots of other folks from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in the weeks and months to come. So
you know,
all the news is that. I'm sorry.
We get pretty good people in this agency, and it's a remarkable bunch of people and pretty dedicated.
They are. In fact, we have a Facebook page, and tonight we did something. Well, I should say my dear wife Cheryl did something. We had a chance to meet one of the agents when we were at the National Conservation Training Center last October, and we had out our baboon, and he says, "Gosh, it's so great to see this animal alive." Because he was talking about some of the investigative work they've done with the god-awful delicacy that gets shipped around the world and so illegal, bushmeat. And we did quite a story on that on our Facebook page. And I don't think a lot of people even realize some of the things the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is involved with.
Oh, my goodness. The law enforcement stories we could tell, not only domestic wildlife, but international trade, stuff coming into this country, stuff going from this country all over the world. We've investigated the illegal trade in bear gallbladders to the medicinal markets in Asia coming out of the Appalachians. And, you know, in fact, I did a story some years ago about the trade in gallbladders. I mean, these magnificent creatures being killed simply for the gallbladder and nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
And to be put into trade, we discovered, though, with the assistance of our National Forensics Laboratory, our National Wildlife Forensics Laboratory in Ashland, Oregon, that a lot of the what's being passed off as bear gallbladders was actually pig gallbladders.
Oh.
Procured from slaughterhouses. So not only were people getting engaging in illicit wildlife trade, but they were getting ripped off in the process with material that wasn't even North American black bear, which goes to show you there is no honor among thieves.
No, there's not. In fact, I remember reading somewhere, and I want to say the National Geographic, that they had busted or arrested a fellow, man, whatever, that had killed over 600 bears out of the Smoky Mountains alone.
Mm-hmm.
So
I haven't stayed in touch with the latest on that. I think it's sort of an endemic thing that kind of comes and goes. It's never stamped out, but we've turned the spotlight on it some years ago and got a lot of good cooperation with state agencies and other federal agencies, and hopefully that trade is diminished. We've been involved with the illegal trade in falcons and other raptors going to the Middle East from some of the Midwestern states. Some years back, we had a reptile sting operation going in Atlanta and just uncovered, and this is up your alley, Larry, just such a tremendous trade, illegal trade in snakes, turtles, lizards, and a lot of it moving through the U.S. mails, which is illegal.
Right.
We've investigated the feather trade. There's quite a illegal trade in feathers in the Southwest and on the West Coast. We get into so many different aspects of wildlife management through our law enforcement responsibilities, and hopefully we've made a dent in the illegal trade. But some years ago, the estimate was that the illegal wildlife trade was second only to the drug trade in its dimensions. And I mean, it's staggering.
It is staggering, and it's sad. It's just too bad. I guess if the course if it didn't go on, there would be people that unemployed. But you know, there is a
as you well know, a fully legal trade in wildlife products.
Sure, there is.
And international trade in wildlife products is legal. We have international conventions that regulate that. But what we're talking about is the black market, the undercover trade, the trade that is completely illegal, completely detrimental to the survival of species in the wild. And we not only have an obligation to our own people to combat that, but we have obligations to other countries to crack down on the international trade. So we do a lot of work with wildlife agencies in foreign nations.
Before we went on the air, we were discussing the recent, crisis, I should say, in the budget of their government and how they're going to possibility of closing down national parks and different parts of government. You had some insight on this.
Oh, I don't have the answer, Larry. If I did, they'd be calling me back to Washington. I was in Washington today on other business, and I know our agency has made some preliminary shutdown arrangements, as have all federal agencies, and we'll know more tomorrow. I haven't stayed in touch with the news this evening. I figure that the Congress has its job to do, and the President has his job to do. But in the meantime, I've got work to do, and here we are at 10 o'clock doing the work of the Fish and Wildlife Service. So we just got to keep on until
told
otherwise. You know, I think my agency, our people are so dedicated, you practically have to throw them out of the office at 6 o'clock in the evening. And I think a lot of them, particularly our folks in the field, our refuge managers, the people that your listeners get to know on a local basis, those folks, they'd probably work for nothing if you took salary out of it, they'd still be coming to the job. They're that dedicated.
Well, they are. And every time I speak to anyone with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the word inspirational just comes right up into my mind every time. And
it's a calling, it's a dedication, and people really do feel that what they're doing not only is to the benefit of the nation, but to the benefit of future generations. And you'll find the same spirit in the National Park Service. And many of the resource agencies, people are very, very committed to what they're doing. They see the big picture. They know the risks if we don't steward these resources. And they want to make sure that this legacy that's been given to us in this nation is passed on to future generations. So that creates an esprit de corps and a dedication that's pretty much unmatched in comparison with other federal agencies. And so we're still on the job tonight, and we're continuing to work.
Well, that makes everyone feel great. In fact, I can't imagine them putting a blockade up into our great national parks, but if they have to do that, I guess they'll have to do that. But I know they'll still be in good hands.
Well, we do have arrangements. We can't just walk away from these assets. So there are very carefully thought out plans for, you know, if this should happen, as it has happened before, that these national parks, these refuges, these facilities do get protected in the interim until this budget impasse is resolved.
Right before our broadcast tonight, in fact, last week I received a very interesting piece of correspondence from yourself. And it was quite a fascinating story. In fact, I've read it two or three times, and I know before we go to break we won't have enough time to complete the story, but I'd like to at least get it started. And as I've told many folks that I've relayed this to, probably one of the most intriguing stories around the events of 9/11. Would you mind telling my listeners around the world this story that I had read about that I found is pretty amazing?
Well, it's a story that's just getting told, and it's particularly relevant this year. You know, we're coming up on the 10th anniversary of 9/11. Mm-hmm. It's kind of hard to believe it's been 10 years.
It is.
I don't know where you were on that day.
I was watching television. And I saw it all live, and it was horrible.
I was driving to work and to our National Conservation Training Center in West Virginia, and we were, strangely enough, we had most of our agency's press officers, public affairs officers, in training that day at our facility, and they were in a crisis communications seminar being taught by a gentleman who is a former reporter with the Miami Herald. And I thought, well, what better way to learn than from reality?
Yeah.
At that time, all we knew was that a small plane, we thought, had crashed into the World Trade Center. And so I interrupted their training and said, turn on the TV. You've got a crisis unfolding right here. Let's see how the national news media handles it, without really any knowledge that this was a terrorist incident and that it had larger ramifications. Well, that quickly unfolded.
Yep.
And then your listeners know the rest of the story, but... But they're untold stories, backstories, I call them, about what happened on 9/11 and what happened to one of our own U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service employees who was killed in the crash of the United Flight 93 in Pennsylvania. And that's just getting told this year. I had a chance to chat with an FBI agent and some of our other employees, and learned a story that's kind of eerie and chilling in some ways, but then very inspirational in another sense.
Mm-hmm.
And I can launch right into it if you want. Or
well, I'll tell you what. Let's take our break because I don't want to disturb one moment of this story, and we want to hear every word that you have to say. So let's take that short break, and we're going to be listening to David Klinger, senior writer for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Folks, it's Thursday night, and you're listening to Larry Batson's Wild World on Blog Talk Radio. We'll be right back.
Stay tuned. We'll be back with more of Larry Batson's Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio.
We're Rascal Flats. There's a place where ordinary people do extraordinary things every day. That place is called the American Red Cross. When you help the American Red Cross, you help America. Call 1-800-RED-CROSS or visit redcross.org to learn more.
Ranger Station, Ranger speaking.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to report a
Bear sighting?
Location.
In the forest, near the side of the road.
No need for alarm, sir. The forest is where bears live.
But this was no ordinary bear.
No ordinary bear?
Yeah, one second I'm having a smoke taken in the view. Next thing I know, I am face to face with Smokey Bear.
Let me guess, Smokey had a tip for you.
He did. He must have seen me toss my cigarette on the ground. He told me never to do that because it only takes one spark to start a wildfire.
He's a smart bear. Did you know that 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans? That means 9 out of 10 wildfires can be prevented.
That's what Smokey said. I had no idea.
That's why Smokey's famous, and you're not.
Good point.
Get your Smokey on. If you see someone in danger of starting a wildfire, step in and make a difference, because 9 out of 10 wildfires are caused by humans. Brought to you by Smokey Bear, the U.S. Forest Service, your state forester, and the Ad Council. Learn more at SmokeyBear.com.
Only you can prevent wildfires.
Welcome back to Larry Batson's Wild World here on Blog Talk Radio. Once again, here's your host, Larry Batson.
Hello, everyone. This is Larry Batson. You are listening to Larry Batson's Wild World on Blog Talk Radio. We're going to be back with David Klinger with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in just a couple moments. We want to tell everyone that we'd like to thank our underwriters, such as McGregor Mountain Lodge in beautiful Estes Park, Colorado, on the boundaries of Rocky Mountain National Park. Folks, we call it God's country. It's absolutely amazing scenery. Go to their website, info@McGregorMountainLodge.com, and that lodge is right on the boundaries of Rocky Mountain National Park, so it's fantastic. So you need to, if you've never been to Colorado and that part of the country, you owe it to yourself to do it one day. Also, a big thank you to Tire Service Plus and owner Jerry Jones, taking care of America's auto maintenance needs. They keep our animal truck on the road, traveling thousands of miles with our wild animal ambassadors. Give them a call, 317-243-0700. Also, a big thank you to RadioMom.fm and the home of the Radio Mom Shop, where you can save 50, 60, 70% on vacations, restaurants, and a variety of other goods and services. And, hey, listen to my show, The 70s on Sunday, 12 to 7, every Sunday at RadioMom.fm. Those are some of our underwriters that make it possible for Larry Batson's Wild World to be on Blog Talk Radio. We'd also like to mention that next week on the show, New York naturalist, wildlife educator Joel Thomas, oh, and I should mention author, he's going to be joining us for what should be a truly fascinating hour next week on Larry Batson's Wild World. Before we did take our break, David Klinger was getting ready to tell us this story I'd already read about, but I wanted to hear it in his own words. A very fascinating series of events that happened around the 9/11 tragedy.
Larry, we had a terrific young refuge manager out on the California coast. His name was Richard Guadagno, and he managed our Humboldt Bay National Wildlife Refuge up in the Eureka Arcata area of Northern California. And when I worked in Portland, I would occasionally see him. I didn't know him well. I knew him by sight, but very well respected. A young refuge manager, and who was had a great future ahead of him. He decided that he would fly back to the East Coast to visit his family in New Jersey back in September of 2001. He was going back to celebrate his grandmother's 100th birthday.
Wow.
He had a family celebration and had a wonderful day there and a visit. And when it came time for his return flight to California, he boarded United Flight 93, the plane that eventually was seized by terrorists and that crashed near Shanksville, Pennsylvania, just east of Pittsburgh. And we know from the flight data recorder and the tapes that were retrieved and the phone calls that were made that a number of the passengers on that flight were certainly aware of what was going on elsewhere in the country. They were aware that that plane was intended as a missile to aimed at Washington D.C. that could have crashed into the White House or the Capitol, and through their efforts, they brought that plane down prematurely in the fields of western Pennsylvania. Well, we lost one of our best employees that day. It's something that shook the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to its foundations. Rich's memory is memorialized on a fallen comrades wall that we maintain for our agency here at our training center in Shepherdstown, West Virginia. At the time, there was very little evidence or artifacts that were uncovered from the crash scene. They did reportedly recover a piece of his law enforcement badge out of the crash scene that later turned out to be slightly incorrect. There was a lot of confusion, of course, that day and in the subsequent investigation. But very little came out of that crash scene intact. And one of the concerns was that his law enforcement credentials may have survived that crash. If his badge came through it, perhaps there were some other personal possessions that might have survived. Law enforcement officers take their credentials and their badge very seriously. It's something you aren't without. You don't check it in luggage. You keep it on you. That was really his authority to enforce federal law. The crash scene really didn't yield up any more evidence. I got to talking to an FBI agent some years ago. He said, "Well, you know, I helped investigate the Pentagon crash scene right after 9/11, and in fact, this agent, Ed Ryan is his name, worked virtually nonstop for a month or two afterwards. These guys were just hammered on the investigations. He finally decided one day in late October that he needed to decompress. I don't know. I know the shock around the nation, of course, it goes without saying. In Washington, right, it was even more perceptible. We could feel it out here. We're about 85 miles west of Washington, and one of the eeriest sounds that I never heard was the stillness over Washington. You didn't hear planes for the first few days after the terrorist incidents because all flights had been grounded. We would occasionally be woken up in the middle of the night. You'd hear a F-15 fighter jet circling over Washington. You could hear that. Mm-hmm. But believe me, the stillness was very eerie. This agent, Ed Ryan, after so many days of investigating the aftermath of 9/11 at the Pentagon, said, "I need to decompress. I need to get away for a day." He decided he'd hop on his motorcycle and head west and go up to the Shanksville site. There was something nagging at him that said, "You need to get up there. You need to see what happened in that location." He was restless, and he simply wanted time out on the road to by himself to decelerate, to renew himself. So he did. This was in late October, 6 weeks or more after the terrorist incidents. The night before his visit to the Shanksville crash site, a big wind had passed through western Pennsylvania. And I know that because I went back through the weather records
for Pennsylvania and looked at the National Weather Service data, and indeed a very strong wind blew through Shanksville the night before Agent Ryan appeared on the scene. And sometime during that night, our refuge manager's credentials, Richard Guadagno's credentials, came floating down to earth.
Whoa.
They had been up in a tree overlooking the crash site for 6 weeks. No one had found them, and believe me, they had combed that crash site. There were hundreds of investigators up there for weeks, and no one had found anything. No one knew these credentials were caught way up in the top branches of some trees. And that night, the wind came through, blew those credentials, those law enforcement ID badges and whatnot, down to earth. And Agent Ed Ryan, the next morning, looked down, and there they were at his feet.
Oh.
Now, that crash site had been essentially closed. After the investigation, they brought in bulldozers and kind of leveled the crater and knocked down some of the damaged trees and graded it and declared it a closed scene. So any little shaking of that tree by a bulldozer or earth-moving equipment would have caused those credentials to have been just been buried and never seen again. But through chance, through, call it fate, call it coincidence, the most important credentials that a law enforcement officer can possess, that our refuge manager cared for so carefully because they were a symbol of his right to protect America's resources, they came down from that tree and by chance landed at the feet of an FBI agent who something had told him that he needed to go up there that day. And so we were able to restore to Rich's family these mementos that in some way and in a small way express his devotion to duty and our devotion to him as one of our fellow employees.
That had to give Agent Ryan a special, I don't know, feeling, or it had to be eerie for him to make that trip all that way. I mean, how many miles is that?
Well, it's about a 4-hour road trip from suburban Washington, suburban Baltimore, up to Shanksville. So he'd never been up there before. Wasn't expecting to find anything. Just felt like he needed to go up there and pay homage to a site that was already attracting people. There was a small makeshift memorial there.
Mm-hmm.
But he just felt like, I've got to escape Washington. I can't deal another day with this high-pressure investigation, the aftermath of the inferno that was one side of the Pentagon. I need to get away, and something's telling me to go to Shanksville and pay tribute up there. And he did, and he was the right man in the right place at the right time. And you can call it coincidence, or you can call it fate. But it happened. It's never been told before. And 10 years after this worst terrorist incident in American history, we're finally telling it.
Well, God bless him, because I know after spending all that time sifting through that mess of the Pentagon, to see all what he probably had seen, and to go up there and do that just to pay homage, my gosh, what a strong individual he is.
He's a remarkable man, very dedicated, of course, as every FBI agent is, but he can still get very emotional about this. There's something operating here that was, you know, kind of beyond our ability to understand. But it's just one of many, many little backstories connected with 9/11 that will be told. The National Park Service will be dedicating its new memorial in Shanksville later this year. I have an idea it will be around September 11th, and there will be a permanent memorial maintained by the National Park Service, and we at the National Conservation Training Center have made sure that our files and records relating to Rich Guadagno get incorporated into that memorial. They're going to be very focused not only on what happened there, but the people that were involved in this terrible tragedy.
You know, that's so important, because those individuals on that plane, to do what they did, I mean, it's just, it's unimaginable. I mean, that it's...
Well, we have no doubt that Rich was right there at the cockpit trying to bring that plane down. He did have law enforcement authority. He did have law enforcement training. So he undoubtedly, and I think the evidence that the investigation turned up and the tapes and whatnot show that these folks were real heroes, and they prevented a much greater tragedy that 9/11 could have been.
Oh, it could
have
been.
If this plane had reached Washington.
So can't even imagine.
We're telling this story this month in our employee newsletter, Fish and Wildlife News, and we try to ferret out the stories that don't always get told, or that sometimes have to percolate a little bit before they can be told. And that's one of my jobs, is to get these little bits of history, these little urban legends, these little stories that everybody knows about but have never really been recorded, to get the stories told. And that's one of the more interesting aspects of my job. For instance, Larry, I wanted to I had a couple other stories up my sleeve, if you've got a
couple. Oh, we certainly do. Yes, absolutely.
Did you know the Fish and Wildlife Service was the biggest chef in the federal government?
Really?
We used to run test kitchens in College Park, Maryland, on the campus of the University of Maryland, back in the 1930s, 40s, on into the 60s. We had a staff, they were all women, and they just dreamed up recipes for primarily fish. There was a great effort during World War II to get people to eat more fish.
Oh.
Because most of the meat in this country was going to the military. So the great challenge for the Fish and Wildlife Service, which had commercial fishing responsibilities, was to convince the American public to eat more fish.
Well.
And to eat different kinds of fish than we were used to eating.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how do you get people to do that? Well, you got to get them the recipes.
Mm-hmm.
So we had five or six women whose primary job was to test out recipes.
Well.
And to convince people that they should be substituting, instead of steaks and chicken, that they should be eating seafood and shellfish, and some of the things that people back 60, 70 years ago weren't used to eating. You know, you couldn't always get good seafood in this country.
Mm-hmm.
So they were up out there dreaming up turtle soup recipes. They even did some. They even cranked out some recipes for other species like wine-fried muskrat.
Oh!
Marsh rabbit. Have you ever eaten a marsh rabbit?
I have not, I have to say. I've tried the rabbit, though. It has to be cooked a long time.
How about wine-fried muskrat? I think you've got to be pretty hungry to eat one of those.
Well, I imagine that recipe is still in circulation down in Arkansas and Louisiana.
Well, you know, we would package these recipes into little booklets, and the government would provide them to people, and then they would crank out news releases to promote these recipes and to incorporate seafood recipes into your holiday entertaining. And the one writer, you laugh, this is true, the one writer who did most of the recipe writing, her name was Rachel Carson.
Oh, well.
And so she wasn't always writing Silent Spring and The Sea Around Us and all these other wonderful books. She was also writing press releases about entertaining with
muskrat
appetizers made from muskrat and lynx and all sorts of strange species.
Oh my gosh!
Now we had a guy that worked for this agency. Another true story.
Mm-hmm.
Years ago, he worked for Fish and Wildlife Service down in New Mexico and Arizona, and they said he was a guy who would eat anything.
Uh-oh.
He would eat anything. He could make a soup made out of the carcasses of mice, chipmunks, gophers, and pack rats.
Oh.
He had stewed lynx meat that he would, up in Labrador, he did some work for the Canadian government, and he would take some lynx meat, soak it in sherry for a month, and then stew it up in a pan and eat it in a brown gravy.
Oh!
Well, this guy went on to greater fame. He discovered when he was up in the frigid north that you could preserve meat when it was quick frozen out of doors, and you could preserve vegetables like cabbages. You'd freeze them in seawater, and they would preserve, and you could thaw them out weeks or months later and eat them.
Oh my God.
He learned the secrets of quick freezing, and he went on to kind of synthesize this process and develop it and provide it to private industry. And this Fish and Wildlife Service employee's name was Clarence Birdseye.
Oh, and well.
When you go to the frozen food section of any grocery store in America,
yes,
and you see a Birdseye frozen food, frozen vegetable box,
yes,
you should know that that was a Fish and Wildlife Service employee who popularized the process of quick freezing of vegetables and meats.
Well, it's amazing. Now, my question, David, is the cookbook or the recipes, are they still available in the archives of the Fish and Wildlife Service?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, we'll gladly, Larry, if you'd like to catch a muskrat out there in Indiana and you're at a loss for how to prepare it, we'll help you.
Now, I need that. Go ahead.
We do have all these recipes carefully preserved, and they're available online, and some of them are still pretty good.
Well, as the moments after our broadcast tonight, I'm planning on discussing this with my wife.
We'll send you a recipe book.
Oh, would you please?
Now, I'm working on it. I don't know how much time you have here. I want to give you a little teaser on a story I'm working on that has yet to see print. But this story involves J. Edgar Hoover, the U.S. Congress, the National Aquarium, and a bowl full of goldfish.
Oh, please.
And this was a story that was broken by Jack Anderson, the famous muckraking journalist in the 1960s and 70s, and involves the Fish and Wildlife Service and some things we used to do with fish in Washington that got into the news in a big way during the Watergate era.
Really?
And I'm not going to say anything more about it because I'm just teasing you tonight. But by the time we talk again, the story will be out and I'll have it for you.
Oh, that would be fantastic. That would be. Go ahead.
It's just amazing. The more you look around, the more stories you find that are just fascinating, that really emphasize what a unique agency this is, what interesting people work for the American public in this agency, and just the amazing contributions that have been made that you don't, on the surface, you don't really realize. But
you don't.
So we have no shortage.
I have such a great pride every year when we go into the National Conservation Training Center. When I'm arriving, I have great pride and a big smile on my face. And when I'm leaving, there's a sadness, but also a great deal of satisfaction to know that I have such wonderful friends with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and what a magnificent place, and how kind they have been to my wife and I over the last, 11 or 12 years that we've been visiting Shepherdstown, West Virginia. It's always a fantastic trip.
Larry, will we have you back again this fall?
Well, as far as I know, that we're going to come back.
That's when our open house for the public is generally in one of the last Saturdays in October that we open this tremendous facility up to the local community, to everyone, to spend the day, to learn about what we do, to attend your shows, which are the highlight of our open house every year.
Well.
And who knows, I might have a good pan full of wine-fried muskrat for you. we'll talk to the folks in the cafeteria, see if we can dish something up for you and your wife.
Well, that would be, I can tell you right now, my wife would, there'd be a little bit of throw up in her mouth. What the thought of it. But I'll tell you, we went to an event for the Explorers Club, and they had a big punch bowl, and the liquid was pink, and I was informed that it was blood milk, the common drink of the Maasai at the Maasai Mara Reserve in Africa. And we were there with Jim Fowler, and needless to say, I wasn't ladling out any of this cocktail for myself. And they had quite a wide variety of exotic fauna. And as I told the people there, I said, I can't eat a lion. I've been friends with many of them for so many years. It's just, it's like I can't even eat frog legs or lobsters. It's just, oh, my Lord, I'm terrible. So, muskrat. But I do want to see the cookbook, though.
Well, we'll get that to you, and you can try out a few recipes from the 1930s, and next time we talk, you can give me the lowdown on how they are.
Well, I'll tell you what, when I get the cookbook, we might have a recipe segment each week on the show where I can relay these recipes.
Yeah, I see a whole nother show in your future here.
I could become the Rachel Ray of exotic fauna. David, it's been an absolute pleasure. We ran out of time last time you were on, and the hour has just literally flown by. You're such a fantastic storyteller. I know that the listeners around the world, they're just grasping to every word that you say. Fantastic writer, fantastic speaker, I mean. What an extraordinary hour you've given us. We appreciate
Thank you so much, Larry. It's always a pleasure being with you.
It pleasure's all ours. We want to tell everyone next week on the program, naturalist educator Joel Thomas from the state of New York. It was a dandy, wasn't it, Dr. Day?
You know what? I had a frozen muskrat dinner tonight.
You did?
Yeah.
Wow, bird's eye?
I believe it was.
Well, that's extraordinary. Well,
thank you, David.
Remind everyone to check out my website, LarryTheAnimalGuy.com, and our brand-new Facebook page, Larry the Animal Guy and Friends, filled with photos and information about our animal family. Folks, it's been a fantastic hour with the senior writer for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, David Klinger. I want to thank Melissa Hovey and Wayne Larson in the state of Ohio for keeping us on the air and taking care of all the technical responsibilities. This is Larry Batson. Have a great week, everybody. We'll talk to you next Thursday. This is Larry Batson's Wild World on Blog Talk Radio. Good night, everyone.
Thanks for listening this week to Larry Batson's Wild World. Be sure to join us again next week at 10 p.m. for more of the latest outdoor and wildlife news and information, along with great tales from your host, world-renowned wildlife expert, Mr. Larry Batson. Tune in again next week for another exciting edition of Larry Batson's Wild World. Larry Batson's Wild World is a Batson Wildlife Educational Services production in association with Blog Talk Radio.